From the studios of NPR West, this is Day to Day. I'm Madeline Brand.
And I'm Alex Cohen. Coming up, skepticism from political analysts in the Middle East about the presidential candidates here in the U.S.
But first, let's turn to Iraq. The bodies of two American soldiers missing for more than a year have been found. Sergeant Alex Jimenez from Massachusetts and Private Byron Futi of Michigan were kidnapped more than a year ago in May of 2007. It was during an ambush in an area near Baghdad known as the Triangle of Death. The body of a third soldier who was also kidnapped then, Private First Class Joseph Anzac of California, that his body was found a year ago. Meanwhile, in Britain, authorities have agreed to pay nearly $6 million to nine Iraqis who were tortured and to the family of one Iraqi who died in custody. This happened in Basra some 5 years ago. John Burns of the New York Times is here with the details. And John, first, the man who died, he, I understand, was a hotel receptionist. What happened? Why was he arrested in the first place?
Well, let's remember the time. It was September 2003, about the time that Britain and the United States together discovered that they weren't going to be in Iraq to keep a peace, they were going to be in Iraq to fight a war. The British began to discover that they were facing a major challenge in the south at that time from Sunni insurgent militias, and they raided a hotel, the Haytham Hotel, where they had an intelligence tip suggesting that there was an insurgent base. They did find weapons, and they did find, so they said, bomb-making equipment. They took 10 people away. Serious abuses took place in which one of them, the hotel receptionist, Baha Musa, died.
And did they determine how he died?
Well, the autopsy showed that he had 93 separate injuries. British troops, in this case the Queen's Lancashire Regiment, had not been informed that the use of various stress techniques had actually been forbidden by the British Prime Minister Edward Heath in 1972. Lawyers for the nine men who survived this and for Mr. Musa, who died, have said that the abuses included sitting on imaginary chairs, wall standing, which speaks for itself, and a kind of kickboxing routine in which, so these lawyers say, the British soldiers kicked the Iraqis around the room. And the pictures of Mr. More than 150 of them, which the lawyers for the Baha Musa family made available, showed Mr. Baha Musa's body, and it was pretty plain that he'd been knocked about pretty badly.
What happened to the British troops who were involved?
Well, there was a court-martial, and it was the most expensive and longest-running court-martial in British Army history. And those accused included the commander of the Queen's Lancashire Regiment battalion that was involved in this, and eight others. One man, a corporal, pleaded guilty to inhumane treatment of a prisoner, and he was given a year's prison sentence. The others pleaded not guilty and were found not guilty. They were acquitted. But that didn't satisfy, of course, the Iraqi petitioners in this case. And there was a further inquiry by the Defense Ministry, which acknowledged that there were serious abuses. And in announcing the settlement yesterday, the Defense Ministry talked about substantive breaches of human rights. So from the Defense Ministry's point of view, not only did things go seriously wrong in Basra, but the whole investigative procedure proved to be inadequate for the purpose. And so they're hoping that by paying compensation to the families, the survivors, $6 million, that will go some way, if you will, if one can use the phrase, to binding up the wounds of this affair.
Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure.
That's New York Times reporter John Burns speaking to us from London.
Turning now to politics in the U.S., where Barack Obama is leading John McCain by a small margin in most of the major polls. Obama fares even better in Europe. He's up by 52 points in Belgium. But there are some political pundits overseas who aren't as strong on the candidate. Many opinion leaders in the Middle East are skeptical of Barack Obama. It's a topic that Robert Lane Green writes about in The New Republic, and he joins us now. A lot of people say that electing Barack Obama would be a great way to revamp the U.S. image in the Middle East, but as you write, many critics are warning against him. Why is that?
Well, it's true that, first of all, Barack Obama would revamp a lot of America's image around the world, and that does include the Middle East. But what my colleague Josie DeLapp and I looked at in our article is specifically the sort of opinion leaders, the type of people who have a column on an op-ed page in a big newspaper in the Arab world and how they responded to Barack Obama. And we found on three issues in particular, on Iran and Iraq, and especially on Israel and the Palestinian issue, that they're a lot more skeptical about Barack Obama.
What specifically are their concerns?
Well, first on Iran, I think that's probably the most optimism there, but they are seeing him hedge quite a bit on his position about negotiating with Iran. He said first that he would negotiate without preconditions, and then he made this fine distinction between preconditions and preparations, which seemed to be backing off a little bit. The second one on Iraq is that he seems to have moved from talking about a quick withdrawal to now talking about a cautious and thoughtful withdrawal, which has a lot of Arab commentators thinking that he may not be interested in getting out in all that big of a hurry. But by far the biggest issue and the most emotional one is the question of Israel and the Palestinians, because the speech that he gave to AIPAC, the Jewish lobby here in the United States, was one in which he promised a quote, undivided capital as Jerusalem for the Israelis, and that he re-pledged support, military support for Israel and so forth, basically mainline positions in the United States, but it had Arabs looking at the United States position and Barack Obama's position and saying, what's the difference? Where's the revolution we've been promised?
But as you write, it seems like many Arab analysts put this into context and realize that Barack Obama is running for president, and there are certain groups he needs to appease if he wants to get elected.
Well, they do see that. They actually, we're talking about fairly sophisticated analysts of American politics. One of our quoted writers, Raghida Dergham, is a writer for Al Hayat magazine. She's here in New York. She's a regular at the Council on Foreign Relations meetings and so forth. These are people who understand the political constraints that an American candidate faces, but that's just the problem. They look at these constraints and they say, okay, we may have this heroic new figure in Barack Obama, but what's really going to change? You know, a newspaper columnist is almost by definition a professional cynic, and so we're seeing a lot of skeptical, very realistic, beady-eyed assessments of him in that particular class.
What about Senator John McCain? How does he fare with these analysts?
The reaction to McCain is not surprising. Most of the views on him see him as a continuation of George Bush's foreign policy. The issues in which he's bucked George Bush, things like tax cuts and other things like that, those are domestic issues that don't play as big in the Arab world. But I should point out, and it's interesting, that there's just simply a lot more interest in Obama, period, than there is in John McCain. A couple of just simple metrics. If you Google Obama in Arabic, you'll get about 2 million hits. If you Google McCain in Arabic, you get about 300,000, so about one-sixth or one-seventh as many. There's just a lot more discussion about Obama. There's just a lot more interest, period.
Of course, neither of these candidates are running for office in the Middle East, so to what extent does it really matter, these external opinions about the two candidates?
The hope is that a new president comes in who engenders enough goodwill in the Middle East so that leaders there can feel comfortable making compromises. If the publics are in an uncompromising mood and they're being whipped up by their newspaper columnists, then political leaders there will feel less domestically able to make compromises.
Robert Lane Green is an international correspondent for The Economist. Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's continue now with presidential politics. This week, both candidates had reason to ask that age-old question, with friends like these, .. For Obama, the friend in question was the Reverend Jesse Jackson. For McCain, it was former Texas Senator and now former economics advisor Phil Graham. Joining us now is our friend, always, NPR News analyst Juan Williams. Hi, Juan.
Hi, my old friend.
Not so old. Who are you calling old?
Hey, my young friend.
Okay, well, by now everyone knows the gist of what Jesse Jackson said on Fox. And I'm just wondering, is Reverend Jesse Jackson, is he speaking for an older generation of African-American leaders?
I think he is, Madeline, but he's also speaking for himself. I think he's got great concern about being pushed off stage by a new kind of political leadership that's speaking on pragmatic terms about problems in Black America and saying we've got to fix the schools, we've got to contend with this dropout rate. And Barack Obama on Father's Day spoke in a Black church in Chicago and said Black fathers have to do a better job of being responsible parents. He also said in some cases maybe the government should be funding churches as part of the President Bush's faith-based initiative to deliver social services, revealing in the sense that Barack Obama was talking about Black people taking personal responsibility, not playing into the victim mindset and saying the government should be doing this or white people are responsible for our plight, but here are steps you can take to help yourself. And I think Jackson felt that's not the message that a prominent Black leader should be delivering. In an earlier occasion during this campaign cycle, by the way, when there was protest down in Louisiana against the treatment of some Black high school students, Barack Obama said, well, let the justice system work. Jesse Jackson's response was, he's acting white. So again, I think you see that generational divide come into play. And should Barack Obama be elected president, you can expect to see more of it.
Well, politically, does Obama come out looking better because of it?
You know, it's interesting because as a matter of political strategy, right now, Barack Obama, as you know, has been moving to the center. He's after independent white voters, especially suburbanites and especially women. And for them to say, oh, wait a second, he is at a distance from Jesse Jackson. These are not the same people. That can only help Barack Obama.
Maybe a real friend then in
well,
Jesse
Jackson. That's right. Maybe not intentionally, but in fact, a friend.
Okay, so let's turn to John McCain. He also had a problem with former Texas Senator Phil Gramm, who made some interesting remarks about Americans who are complaining about the current state of things in the economy, basically saying we are a nation of whiners. McCain came out forcefully saying he didn't agree with that.
Big problem for John McCain here, Madeline, because when you get former Senator Gramm, who, you know, is a PhD in economics, saying most Americans are suffering what he called a mental recession and are whining and complaining for no reason. Look at the unemployment rate. Look at Wall Street. Look at profits. What are they complaining about? He really contradicted what McCain is trying to deliver as now the core message of his campaign, which is that we are in touch with the economic anxiety in the country and Republicans are going to take action to help you with kitchen table issues. And that's why McCain was quick to say, Phil Gramm doesn't speak for me. In addition, Madeline, he also said maybe he would appoint former Senator Gramm as ambassador to Belarus. But then he said maybe the people there wouldn't want him.
Juan, your best political conversation of the week?
You know, Madeline, this is an interesting one. This week, if you remember, President Bush won on FISA legislation that gave immunity to the telecom companies. And in discussions on Capitol Hill this week, there were people who were asking me, do you think that Bush ever stops and thinks that he has won every major fight when it comes to this terror issue? Obama voted for this legislation. Even a democratically controlled Congress fears President Bush and refuses to challenge him on the civil liberties issue. This is the start of a conversation we're going to have more of as we get towards the end of the Bush term. Exactly what did the Bush presidency mean?
Thank you very much.
You're welcome, Adam.
Have a great weekend. That's NPR News Analyst Juan Williams.
This is Day to Day. I'm Alex Cohen.
I'm Madeline Brand. This month, we're taking a look at healthcare systems in Europe and how they compare with ours. Somehow, they're able to cover everyone at a fraction of what we spend on healthcare. Many U.S. experts are interested in the French system in particular. NPR's Joseph Shapiro explains why.
In 2000, the World Health Organization rated healthcare around the world. France came in first. The United States ranked 37th. And this year, two researchers at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine measured something called amenable mortality. Basically, it's a measure of deaths that could have been prevented with good health care. Again, France came in first. The U.S. was last. Now some American experts, like historian Paul Dutton at Northern Arizona University, say there's a lot we can learn from the French. For starters, says Dutton, the French system is not what most Americans imagine.
Well, I think that Americans assume that if it's in Europe, which France is, that it's socialized medicine. The French don't consider their system socialized. In fact, they detest socialized medicine. That's for the French, that's the British. That's the Canadians. It's not the French system.
France, like the U.S., relies on both private insurance and government insurance. Also, just like in the States, people generally get their insurance through the place where they work. In France, everyone has health care. Unlike in Britain and Canada, there are no waiting lists to get elective surgery or see a specialist. Dutton wrote a book called Differential Diagnoses that compares the history of health care in the two countries. He says Americans, like the French, want pretty much the same thing, choice and more choice.
I found that the ideals that French and Americans held in terms of health care, specifically wanting choice of doctor, and doctors wanting really a lot of freedom of clinical decision-making. Both peoples want a private physician and lots of choice within the hospital system.
Dutton says these shared values come out of a shared history. Both countries are products of Enlightenment-era revolutions.
The French hold individual liberty and social equality very dear, right? Liberty, equality, and fraternity, of course, the slogan of their revolution. And in this country, of course, we have similar ideals, individual liberty, social equality, the equal chances for everyone.
But Dutton says the French have done a better job of protecting those values in healthcare. Here's how the French healthcare system works. The national insurance program is funded mostly by payroll and income taxes. Those payments go to several quasi-public insurance funds that then negotiate with medical unions to set doctors' fees. The government regulates most hospital fees. That's how France keeps costs down. When someone goes to see a doctor, the national insurance program pays 70% of the bill. Most of the other 30% gets picked up by supplemental private insurance, which almost everyone has. It's easily affordable, and much of it gets paid for by the place where you work. Victor Rodwin at New York University and the International Longevity Center studies the French healthcare system.
There are no uninsured in France.
Does anyone ever go broke over their personal healthcare costs in
France? No, that's completely unheard of. There is no case of anybody going broke over their healthcare costs. In fact, the system is so designed that for the 3 or 4 or 5% of the patients who are the very sickest, those patients are exempt from their copayments to begin with. There are no deductibles.
That's another lesson from the French system. In France, the sicker you are, the more coverage you get. For people with one of 30 long-term and expensive illnesses, including diabetes, mental illness, and cancer, the government picks up 100% of their healthcare costs. For surgeries, therapies, even for the most expensive drugs. When compared to people in other countries, the French live long and healthy lives. Rodwin says that's because good care starts at birth.
When you're a new mother, you're very well taken care of in France. They take very good care of their mothers when they're pregnant. There's, of course, no problem of uninsured mothers. They get good prenatal care, and they have house visitors, nurses who come to the house and help the mothers in the first week.
Are you ready? Are you ready?
On a recent spring morning, Mary Lou Sarrazin, a young American mother married to a French husband, comes to a park with her baby daughter.
You're so cute.
Sarrazin came to Paris to teach English. She'd tell her teenage students about life in the States.
So when I was explaining to them the concept of health care and health insurance, oh la 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 la. I mean, they were so shocked that if you were sick and you did not have health insurance, you could go bankrupt. To them, that made absolutely, positively no sense because America is seen as the greatest country in the world.
When her teaching job ended and her visa expired, she returned to the U.S. and then was surprised to find herself among those 47 million Americans with no health insurance. She was pregnant and unemployed, and no insurer would sell her health insurance. So she moved back to Paris to have the baby. In France, there's months of paid job leave for mothers who work. Johnson got a child allowance that went for things like buying diapers. She found a country that provides health care and social support for new mothers in ways far beyond what she found at home.
I mean, I love America, but when it comes to, like, the family unit, I just noticed that France creates a system. Like, there's something called creche, which is like a daycare, which is very, very affordable. If she's ever sick, I can just take her to any doctor and be able to pay for her. No problem.
So by now you're probably thinking, what's all this cost? France's healthcare system is one of the most expensive in the world, but the U.S. has the most expensive. Workers in France are required to pay about 21% of their income into the national healthcare system. Employers pick up a little more than half of that. And although Americans don't pay as much in taxes, they do end up paying more for healthcare when you add in the cost of buying insurance and the higher out-of-pocket expenses for medicine, doctors, and hospitals. So the French get more for less. But France, like all countries, faces rising costs to health care. And in a country that's so generous, it's even harder to get those expenses under control. The health system is running a deficit. So in France, those benefits are being trimmed, and there will be more cuts to come. Joseph Shapiro, NPR News.
Je suis une enfant malgré. Taiwan and mainland China have long had strained relations. China considers Taiwan to be a rebel province. Taiwan sees itself as an independent democracy. As the Olympic Games approach next month, tensions between the two are heating up, in large part because of the name China plans on using for the Taiwanese Olympic delegation. New York Times reporter Ed Wong has been covering this story, and he joins us now. Thanks for joining us. And can you explain what exactly this name is that China has been using and why it bothers Taiwan?
The Taiwanese Olympic Committee is called Chinese Taipei. Basically, they had reached a compromise back in the 1980s with both the International Olympic Committee and with China to call this Chinese Taipei, not refer to it by other names by which Taiwan is known, such as the Republic of China or Taiwan or the Chinese Olympic Committee. And the word Chinese in Chinese Taipei can be written in different forms and spoken in different forms in the Chinese language. China prefers it to call it Zhonghua Taipei, which basically implies that Taiwan is part of the political entity known as China. And Taiwan prefers to call it Zhonghua Taipei, and that can mean a couple of things. First, that word is used in the name Republic of China, that the traditionally dominant Taiwanese political party prefers to call Taiwan. And it's also, Zhonghua refers to the Chinese ethnicity also, just more in ethnic terms rather than any concrete political term.
And as you write, what this name is winds up determining all sorts of things, including their placement in the opening ceremonies.
That's right. Usually in most of the Olympics, perhaps all of the Summer Games in the past, the countries will march into the stadium according to their English names. And so Taiwan would march in under T, which would generally refer to either the Taipei in Chinese Taipei or we refer to Taiwan. But this year, the delegations will march into the Beijing Stadium under their Chinese names. And so Taiwan will not be placed in the T's. It'll be placed next to the Central African Republic.
This week, Taiwan said that this name that China's been using was inappropriate and unacceptable. How far are they willing to go to prove that point? Any chance that they'd boycott the games?
I don't think they'll boycott the games. I think they might raise a formal complaint with the IOC, the International Olympic Committee, because the official name is Chinese Taipei, and if China wants to try and make a political statement, then they can raise that issue and basically accuse China of politicizing the Olympics. And the IOC did warn China against using the Olympics for any political purposes just a week or two ago because one Chinese official made a comment about Tibet during the torch relay. And I think while the torch is passing through a city, it might have been Lhasa, in fact. The official said Tibet will always be a part of China. And then the IOC basically reprimanded China for bringing politics into the Olympics. And I think if Taiwan complains about China's use of names, then it might bring a warning from the IOC.
At the Games, China and Taiwan are going to face off against each other in several different sports. It sounds like the big one here is ping pong, and you've spoken with a number of the players on the Taiwanese team. How are they feeling about this competition?
As athletes, they're definitely looking forward to it if such a matchup does occur, because China is basically the dominant ping pong country in the world. It turns out extraordinary ping pong players, and its ping pong players go on to play for other countries like in Hong Kong and Singapore, for example. And the Olympic ping pong teams in those countries are actually mostly mainland immigrants. And so I think in terms of like the Taiwanese athletes wanting to play the best of the best, and they're keeping their eye on the mainland. Obviously, if there were a medal matchup between the two entities, then that might lead to some political overtones. And I'm sure that there are many Taiwanese on the island of Taiwan who would be very, very proud if Taiwan were able to beat China, and for political reasons, too. They'll feel that this is a way of Taiwan asserting itself over the mainland, which has always tried to control Taiwan since Taiwan basically broke off from the mainland. And the athletes I spoke to, they don't want to talk about politics. They say sports is sports and politics is politics.
Ed Wong is a reporter for the New York Times. Thanks, Ed.
Thanks.
From NPR News, it's Day to Day. The stock market is taking a sharp dive today. Investors are worried about Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Those are two quasi-public institutions that back nearly half of the nation's home loans, and they are in trouble themselves. Marketplace's Bob Moon is here now. And Bob, first, tell us more about Fannie and Freddie, what exactly they do and why they are so important to the economy.
Well, as you mentioned, Madeline, these two government-created companies either hold or stand behind $5 trillion worth of mortgages, and that's almost half of all the outstanding home loans in the country. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were created by Congress, Fannie back in 1938 and Freddie more recently in 1970. Their mission is to encourage more home ownership by Americans. What they do is they buy loans from banks, and then they repackage those loans as bonds or promissory notes that are sold to investors. Fannie and Freddie guarantee they'll be repaid, and then once they sell those to investors, they can take much of that money and turn around and provide more for mortgages, and that's the idea. Well, there's always been kind of an implied guarantee that the government wouldn't let these companies fail. And in the past few days, the White House and members of Congress have been talking about ways they might need to come to the rescue if they have to.
Okay, and we'll get to that in a minute. But first, why are they in trouble in the first place, and how serious is it?
Well, lately, as we all know, the market has turned sour. Fannie and Freddie are having to back up a lot of these loans, and they've been losing money. But just last night, the Office of Federal Housing Enterprise Oversight offered reassurances that both of them remain adequately capitalized. And a lot of analysts out there say the fundamentals haven't really changed. What's going on here is just a crisis of confidence among investors.
Okay, so what is the government going to do?
Well, just today, Treasury Secretary Paulson spoke out in Washington. He said the government's primary focus right now is to leave these mortgage giants intact in their current form, he said, as they carry out their mission. We spoke a short time ago to Josh Rosner. He's a consultant at the New York investment research firm Graham Fisher.
The government is in the process right now of considering all options. Now, it's really important that I think people understand that that's considering all options, not for an inevitability, but for a possibility.
Now, Rosner says the problem is this is something that's been developing for a long time, but Washington has been dragging its feet on coming up with answers and really isn't still accepting the seriousness of the problem.
And yet, the government is saying it will stand behind these two companies and not let them fail. So why are investors so worried?
Well, they're worried that if there is a bailout, they could be left holding the bag. You might recall the government rescue involving Bear Stearns. Well, the government didn't let that investment bank fail, but shareholders did end up with big losses anyway. Most of the losses there fell on them, and that's what Wall Street is worried about right now.
Thanks, Bob. That's Bob Moon of Public Radio's daily business show, Marketplace.
This is Day to Day from NPR News. I'm Alex Cohen.
I'm Madeline Brand. In France, the First Lady Carla Bruni is releasing her new album. Carla Bruni has captivated the French with her cat-eyed charm. It may be another matter once they get an earful of her new songs. John Lawrenson reports from Paris.
Carla Sarkozy on a state visit. Carla Bruni in the recording studio. Carla Bruni Sarkozy has a double-barreled life. Her record company was rumored to have thought about putting stickers on the CD saying, "You can like Carla Bruni without liking her husband." But Stéphane Deschamps, music critic with the magazine Les Un Rock, says it's hard to dissociate the two.
It's impossible to separate the album from the fact that Carla Bruni is the wife of Nicolas Sarkozy. It's totally impossible. We tried to do it, but we can't. I can't imagine offering this record to my mother who doesn't like Nicolas Sarkozy or something like that.
Dans ma jeunesse, il y a des rues dangereuses. Dans ma jeunesse, il y a des villes moroses. Des fugues au creux de la nuit silencieuse.
Sarkozy or no Sarkozy, it's a good album, says Stéphane Deschamps. It's less sparse than her previous recordings. The other instruments are up front with her voice and acoustic guitar, giving more of a 1960s pop group sound. But there are the same breathy vocals, the same striking poetic lyrics as on her first album that sold 2 million copies worldwide. Out on the streets, though, I give some Parisians a preview of the album on my Walkman, and Le Peuple is not entirely convinced.
It's not very good. When she's traveling around the world and she's embodying France and she's representing France, we expect from her some form of decency. And I think that we don't get that with her being a performing singer.
It's surprisingly nice. I actually liked it. And the second song is like the famous one, is actually really shocking for the first lady. I sound conventional to say so, but it's immediately like, oh wow, oh no, this is too much.
Plus mortel que l'héroïne afghane, plus dangereux que la blanche colombienne. Tu es ma solution, mon doux problème.
The song that last woman was talking about is called You Are My Cam, a street word for drugs. The object of the singer's affections, Monsieur le Président himself perhaps, is described as more deadly than Afghan heroin, more dangerous than Colombian white. That last line even provoking a complaint from the Colombian foreign minister. Alain Perceval is the author of Carla and Nicholas, The Singer and the President. I put it to him that it would be difficult to imagine former first ladies, Bernadette Chirac, for example, singing this sort of thing.
Well, it's difficult to imagine Bernadette Chirac singing at all. we cannot compare. Of course, we couldn't imagine some time ago Madame de Gaulle being a singer. She was a housewife and nothing else. Times have changed and the mentalities have changed also. I think probably we French people wouldn't have appreciated if he had to stop her career because she married the president.
Malgré me trompe.
I'm a child, sings Carla Bruni, despite my 30 lovers. Ex-lovers, one imagines. Few, if any, compromises then on the artistic front, although she says she probably won't perform live until her husband changes jobs. The security would be too cumbersome. Oh, and there's one compromise with the role of First Lady Bernadette Chirac and the others would have approved of. Profits from the sales of this album are going to charity. For NPR News, I'm John Lawrenson.
While the French president deals with his spouse's new recording, the presidential hopefuls here in the U.S. are trying to choose their running mates. NPR blogger and music reviewer Carrie Brownstein shares this advice.
Choosing a vice presidential candidate is like choosing an opening act for your rock concert. You don't want to alienate your fans by picking a support act that's too different, but a little variety can also appeal to a wider audience. Either way, when the combination of headliner and supporting act is harmonious, or so mismatched as to be genius, it can make for an incredible experience. So with those concerns in mind, I propose a new method on my blog. To choose the vice president, we first have to decide what musicians the candidates are. Who then would be the best supporting act in order to woo the most diverse group of concertgoers, or voters? For instance, if Barack Obama is the Who, big ideas, unconventional, flashy, then maybe the supporting act should be steadier. Someone like Creedence Clearwater Revival. That band conveys a different sense of tradition.
Down on the corner, out in the street, playing the pop of the band, bringing it up.
And if John McCain is, say, Lynyrd Skynyrd, attempting to walk a fine line between mass appeal and rebel stance, maybe John Mayer should be the opener. He's a younger artist who is very much part of the establishment, but likes to try on coolness once in a while, usually to great effect.
It's hard to be persistent when we're standing at a distance, so we keep waiting on the world to change.
Readers sent me their responses. Some surprising.
Just that I didn't think this would happen again. With or without my best intentions and whatever.
McCain is Liz Phair, one reader said. Voters might be able to forget his recent turn to cronyism if they were reminded of his admirable past. And if McCain is Liz Phair, then his running mate will need to be none other than Ted Nugent. which politician is Ted Nugent? Another reader suggested that Obama is Leonard Cohen.
Like a bird on the wire.
On account of his way with words. Like thus, he needs a heavy dose of angst and radicalism to back him up. That means The Clash is his running mate. So, which politician's The Clash? I compiled all the responses in an online poll. Thus far, people see Obama as U2, and therefore feel that Bruce Springsteen is a logical running mate. And the Eagles are who most people imagine as John McCain, though Lawrence Welk is a close second. And Toby Keith is ahead in the polls as a solid opening act.
That justice is the one thing you should always find. You gotta saddle up your boys, you gotta draw a hard line.
Once we determine the results, that McCain is, say, Pat Benatar, and therefore his running mate should be RZA from the Wu-Tang Clan, then all we have to do is decide what politician is most like RZA. After that, we'll let John McCain's people know. You might say this is my version of rocking the vote in 2008.
Carrie Brownstein blogs and reviews music for NPR.org. You can take part in her VP poll by going to NPR.org/music. Back now with Day to Day. This Sunday night on HBO, it's the first installment of Generation Kill, the 7-part miniseries about the war in Iraq. When we asked our TV critic, Andrew Wallenstein, to give us his take on it, he hesitated at first.
You could call me a Philistine. You could even question my patriotism. But I won't hide a shameful secret. The sheer volume of movies and TV series inspired by the conflict in the Middle East has left me numb. Movies like The Kingdom, Redacted, Rendition. I couldn't get through any of them. Nevertheless, I tried Generation Kill for one reason. David Simon and Ed Burns. They adapted Generation Kill for TV from the book of the same name. But I know them better as the creators of The Wire, an HBO series that may just be the finest show US TV has ever produced. I mean, that good. And on paper, Generation Kill sounds compelling. It follows a unit of Marines who led the charge into Baghdad known as Operation Iraqi Freedom. In this scene, the commander of 1st Recon gives the marching orders to his troops. Let's see if you can guess why his nickname is the Godfather.
Rolling through Iraq in open-top Humvees is completely outside of what 1st Recon does. We might not like it, but the general has asked this battalion to be America's shock troops. And Godfather can't tell the general we don't do windows.
And yet, as nicely executed and well-intentioned as Generation Kill is, it still gave me a case of battle fatigue. At first, I believed it was because of the conventional wisdom about why so many of these productions fail. They say the war is so overexposed in the news, on TV, and on the internet that there's little appetite for it in dramatic form. Clearly, Simon and Burns weren't concerned with that. Barely a scene goes by that doesn't evoke the headlines. This scene, in which some Marines use an embedded journalist to get them supplies, brings to mind the lack of sufficient military equipment in Iraq.
As requested. Why do you need me to get you all this stuff?
In the infinite wisdom of whoever runs the military post-exchange stores, they won't sell this stuff in quantity to actual military personnel. Or civilians like yourself. Sky's the limit.
And why is that?
To keep us angry.
But the more I watched Generation Kill, the more I realized it was overexposure to something different than news that was ruining it for me. So much else in the miniseries is familiar not from CNN, but the dozens and dozens of movies I've seen depicting wars of all kinds. The sadistic drill sergeant? Check. The class clown private? Check. Racial tension in the ranks? Check. Ultimately, this genre is so overloaded with clichés that only a film that makes the most radical departure will feel fresh. And so it's time for me to take a break from the genre. Think of it as a non-aggression pact with my local video store. The war movies section is now a demilitarized zone where I can no longer tread.
TV critic Andrew Wallenstein is deputy editor of The Hollywood Reporter.
Do you have questions about what it's like to be a soldier in Iraq right now? Well, Captain Nate Rawlings recently returned to Iraq for a second tour. He is taking your questions. You can learn more at npr.org/Nate.
At the movies this weekend, comedy, sci-fi, and adventure, but sometimes it's hard to tell which film is which. Here's Mark Jordan-Legan with Slate's Summary Judgment.
I'm sure many of you have seen the relatable posters for Meet Dave, where a miniature Eddie Murphy waves from the life-size Eddie Murphy's ear canal. Well, we've all had those days where we feel like a tiny Eddie Murphy is living inside of us. Actually, for me, it's a medium-sized Benicio del Toro right behind the eyes, but that's a whole nother story. In Meet Dave, Murphy is the captain of a crew of tiny space aliens operating their ship, which looks like a regular human being, as they search this strange new planet for minerals they need to survive.
I just don't get out that much.
Yeah, judging from your suit, I'd say since about 1978. You late for a Bee Gees concert or something?
The Bee Gees. Barry, Robin, and Maurice, the brothers Gibb, winning 10 Grammy Awards and selling over 100 million records.
Oh, you can't tell by the way I use my walk. I'm a woman, man. No time to talk. Hey, 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 stay alive. Hey.
The critics don't mind meeting Dave, but many wouldn't have lunch with him. Variety likes it, calling the sci-fi comedy lightly amusing and surprisingly sweet. The Wall Street Journal straddles the fence, finding it dumbfoundingly erratic, but smart and funny from time to time. But the Seattle Post-Intelligencer moans no real wit or cleverness. Guillermo del Toro, the writer and director of Pan's Labyrinth, returns to the fantasy genre with the sequel to his Hellboy franchise with Hellboy 2, The Golden Army. Ron Perlman is back as the misunderstood hero who is ready to battle an evil army of marauders who want to take over Earth.
You have one fatal flaw.
Oh, I want to hear it.
No, you don't. You can't take criticism.
What's my flaw?
Your temper. It gets the best of you, makes you weak, makes you vulnerable.
Hellboy 2 is a fun ride, according to the critics. The Austin Chronicle cheers splendidly imaginative and a creatively uncorked piece of fantastic cinema, and the New York Times smiles pulpy, jokey, sometimes touching, and mostly a lot of fun. Wow, if Hellboy 2 does well at the box office, look for the spin-off Purgatory Tween. And if you crave even more sci-fi and adventure, how about another version of the classic 1864 Jules Verne novel, Journey to the Center of the Earth? Showing at some theaters in 3D, Brendan Fraser leads a crew that accidentally finds this never-before-seen world deep in the Earth's core, a world of dinosaurs and man-eating plants.
Ladies and gentlemen, I give you the center of the Earth.
Critics are split right down the middle like the prime meridian. Even though the Washington Post gurgles terrific family entertainment and the Philadelphia Inquirer shouts cheesy, 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 but fun, 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 Real Views warns the fun dries up long before the running time has expired. See, I've never understood this obsession with even going to the Earth's core. My family and I vacationed there last summer, and let me tell you, don't believe the hype. The center of the Earth is so overrated. Long lines, everywhere you look, it's nothing but iron and nickel alloy. And when we were there, it was really hot. I mean, they claim it's a dry heat, but please, you're at the center of the Earth. It's 11,000 degrees. I don't care how many daiquiris they bring you.
Mark Jordan Ligon is a writer living in a place many consider the center of the universe, right here in Los Angeles.
Day to Day is a production of NPR News with contributions from Slate.com. I'm Madeline Brand.
I'm Alex Cohen.